morning. Hi. Welcome. So this morning I'm going to talk about imagination and ritual. And I'm going to draw on some material from Jack Kornfield's book, Wise Heart. A little bit of material from him and a lot of material from something in here, whatever it is. Okay, imagination and ritual. Jack Kornfield says, knowing the power of symbols, we can recognize them as outer forms that point to our inner world. Well, that's pretty cool. And there's a lot of controversy in Zen about this type of a statement, because the Zen sect developed after a famous Zen master said, the painting of the rice cake will not satisfy your hunger. Some of you know that. The painting of the rice cake will not satisfy your hunger. So symbols and imagination seem to be initially dissed there, don't they? But then we have what happening 500 years later. Monica knows. And what did Dogen say?
Dogen said nothing but a painting of the rice cake will satisfy.
That's right. The painting of the rice cake is what will satisfy our hunger. So what's the deal here? Is this just some Zen contradiction? I don't think so, really. I don't think so. I think that the Chinese teachers were talking about how we get caught in our symbols. We get stuck on our symbols. And they reinforce this sort of obsessive compulsive judgment and criticism that we do. And we need to be careful of that. But Dogen's pointing out we need to be careful of that, but not at the expense of imagination. And if you read Dogen's stuff, he is an incredibly imaginative guy. Incredibly imaginative. The problem is that we use our symbols to reinforce a sense of rigidity, the sense of we've got to be someone, we're not good enough. We got to be someone different. Or maybe you have to be someone different. I'm good enough. Or back and forth, right? Back and forth. So that's why Dogen says, eat all the paintings of the rice cakes you want to. They'll completely satisfy your hunger. Now, you guys may not get this image of paintings of rice cakes, but remember that in Chinese and Japanese culture, rice cakes sustain you. And paintings of rice cakes, normally, one would think, wouldn't sustain you. So imagination is important. We're all sitting here today because we imagine that through sitting here, we'll tap into some calmness. We imagine that we'll experience a little bit of spaciousness. Imagine that. If we didn't imagine that, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be here. And kids, little kids, imagination. But then we're so focused on being good boys and good girls that imagination is suspect. It gets in our way. So at what age? What age do we start dissing imagination? Kind of depends on the culture and the family and the context. Hopefully it never gets dissed, but usually it does. Because we gotta be someone, right? Gotta hold together, we gotta behave better. So, a story that I haven't told in a long time, but this imagination chapter gives me the opportunity to tell it. About my early imaginary friend. When I was 4, I had an imaginary friend. Well, I actually had 3, but that would take all hour to talk about all 3 of them. So instead, I'll talk about my main man. My main man when I was 4 years old was Bobby Shafto. Well, most of you don't even know Bobby Schefter, but if you knew Mother Goose, you know Bobby Schefter. Because I lived at the top of a hill, overlooking the San Francisco Bay and the ocean, and there were no kids up there. We were way up at the top of the hill. So I was lonely. So Bobby Schefter became my main man, my imaginary friend that I hung out with all the time. Bobby Schefter has gone to sea. He'll come back to marry me. Pretty Bobby Schefter. Bobby Schefter's fat and fair, combing down his yellow hair. He's my love forevermore. Pretty Bobby Schefter. He was my love. He was my constant companion and my love. And when I get up in the morning, I look out on the bay and the sea, and Bobby Schefter would come marry me. Every morning he married me. Wow, wonderful, wonderful. And my parents were tolerant up to a point. At one point, my mother was not so tolerant, but I'm not going to get into that right now. And it was good. It fed me. Jack Kornfield says, what we repeatedly visualize, imagine, changes our body and consciousness. It changed my body and consciousness to have Bobby to hang out with. I didn't feel cut off from things. I feel connected to the world around me. I didn't feel so lonely because Bobby was always there with me. And if he was out to sea, I'd just call him in. That's the thing about imagination. It can go any way. It can go any way. So imagination includes, in Buddhist context, but in a worldwide context, naming. Giving a name is important. Remember when you gave your child a name, or when your parents gave you a name, or... it's imagination. It's what we imagine for them. The way it sounds, its meaning, its context, imagination. So my name is... my Christian name, I guess you call it that, is Timothy, right? Timothy. And when I was 9 or 10 years old, I was named after a whole bunch of relatives going back a few generations on the Irish side of my family. And my grandmother, who was probably responsible for my name, I'm sure she was, said to me when I was 9 or 10, oh dear, do you know what Timothy means? I said, Grandma, it means Timothy. And my grandma said, oh dear, didn't your mother tell you? It means Timotheos, honor God. And I thought, oh, Grandma. I said, that's interesting, but Daddy's an atheist. And Mommy says she doesn't know if there's any God. And my grandmother sighed, and she said, that's all right, dear. Honor the God in front of you. Honor the God in front of you, wherever you are, dear. So that was the imagination. That had an effect on me. It had an effect on me at 10 years old. I didn't have to believe in God. I could just honor the God in front of me. And that was my name. So that was something I felt, oh, that was given to me. Even if God didn't give it to me, somebody did. So these names have impact. They have impact. They affect our consciousness. They affect our way of being in the world. So when I became, I went through the first process of initiation in Zen and sewed my first miniature road, Roksu, Katagiri Roshi, the teacher who lived upstairs. I'm pointing upstairs because he lived upstairs. I could be pointing, maybe he is looking over us, or maybe under us. Who knows? Anyway, after he gave me the name, Zentetsu. And then after he gave me that name, and he wrote it on they write it on the back. I don't have one written because I'm totally empty. He wrote it on the back, Zentetsu, and then he said, I said, do you know what it means? I said, no. I didn't say it means zentetsu because I didn't want to be too much of a... And he said it means thoroughgoing Zen. Thoroughgoing Zen. He said it's not zentetsu like that other person's name, which means attainment of Zen. Not attainment, he said. Thoroughgoing. Thoroughgoing. Because when we're trying to attain, the inner critic is always in our way, always evaluating, always criticizing. But if we're just thoroughgoing in who we are and what we do with each activity, it's pretty cool, whatever. It's just pretty cool because it is. So that name also, that's cool. Lucky me. So when I give people names, and I do that, that's part of my role as a Zen teacher, to give names. I think carefully, but I don't really think. I just carefully do nothing, do absolutely nothing. And then I do it again, and then I do it again, and then I do it again, and then I do the name. So I think, but not exactly. Do you know what I mean? So Jack Kornfield talks in his chapter about... Hi! I just saw an old friend in the audience. I wanted to say hi to him. Jack Kornfield talks about visualization in Buddhism. Visualizing bodhisattvas, visualizing... deities, visualizing quietness, and all kinds of visualization exercises that mostly are practiced in Tibetan Buddhism and other kinds of tantric Buddhism like Shingon. So we could say, well, those comments are not relevant to us as Zen students. Well, that's partly true, but he does say that if you do visualization practice 1,000 or 10,000 times, over and over again, it affects you. It affects your body. You begin to embody what you're doing. So we don't exactly do visualization here. I was never trained in it. You guys may do it, but I wasn't trained in it. But we do have exercises in imagination. We do. We have lots of chants, which we're doing less and less of on Sunday, but we still do them on Monday through Thursday, and we do them in our high church retreat that's coming up in the beginning of December. We do a lot of chants for a week of chants, and all those chants are what? They're imagining. They're imagining that we are opening up and becoming the quiescent Buddhas that we already are. Interdependent with each other, interdependent with all life. So we're imagining that. We imagine that. And sutra that we chant most often in our Zen center and in all Zen centers in the United States, and I think most of them in Japan, and a whole bunch of them in China too, for some reason, is the Prajnaparamita Sutra. Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra. I still don't exactly know why, but it doesn't matter. So, and that's the sutra that in which we are in our imagination, we let go of all of our stickiness to any kinds of ideas of self, other. Self or other, of light or dark, or in or out, any of those sticky thoughts that divide us up from life, we let go of them because we go through a huge negation of them. No, 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 no. And then we get to this part where we imagine, in the imagination exercise, after having negated, we then say, know the Prajnaparamita, know the Prajna wisdom, paramita that's gone beyond all our oppositional thinking, all of our internal criticism. It's gone beyond it. So we're imagining that when we chant it. It's gone beyond it. We say, and I don't know why I should be reading this, because I memorized this 35 years ago, but I might could be nervous in front of you guys. Who knows? Here it goes. Know the Prajnaparamita Sutra is the great... Excuse me, I did it wrong. Whoa, the internal critic. Know the Prajnaparamita is the great transcendent mantra, is the great right mantra, is the utmost mantra, is the supreme mantra, which is able to relieve all suffering and is true, not false. So proclaim the Prajnaparamita mantra. Proclaim the mantra that says, Gate, Gate, Paragate, Parasamgate, Bodhisvaha. So what does it say? It says, gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond. We do that imaginative exercise. And nobody ever told me when I started doing it what it meant or what we were doing or that I should visualize it. But at Zen centers, we do it over and over and over again. By the time that I spent my first few months in a Zen monastery, I had already chanted that for... I did a computation yesterday, more than 3,000 times. In a 3-year period, I chanted it more than 3,000 times, it was getting in me. It was getting in me, during a sesshin, which is a traditional retreat at the monastery that I was living at. I was having a really hard time just sitting still without being inundated by self-criticism and by pain in my legs and a sense that this was an impossible thing I was doing. So I went in to have my one-to-one with my teacher. And some of you have heard this before, but many of you have not. And he said, oh, you're having a hard time. And I said, yeah. I didn't say I want to quit, but because actually I didn't want to quit. I didn't want to quit. And he said, well, why don't you repeat the Heart Sutra mantra to yourself? You know that by now, don't you? Having done it more than 3,000 times. And I said, yeah. Yes, he said. Repeat it to yourself. He said, anytime you have a... when you go out of the room, anytime you have a problem, just repeat it. Gyate, gyate, para gyate, para sam gyate, bodhisvaha. And I said, well, should I repeat all of it or just one part? He said, oh, repeat the whole thing, but it's all the same. Well, that wasn't exactly helpful. But I went out, but then I left the room and I started repeating it. And I repeated it when I went to the toilet. I repeated it when I had a pain in my leg. I repeated it when I was eating. Every time my psychic pain would come in, I just gave myself to it. Probably for about 24 hours. I don't know. And then at some point, it ends. Gyate, gyate, para gyate, para sam gyate, bodhi, which means awake. Svaha, which means yippee. So gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, awake, yippee. It finally happened. And I had to run out of the zendo into the woods because I was so overwhelmed with joy and connection to everything Tim Burkett. Timothy Burkett was completely gone. Completely gone. Gyate, gyate. Just wonderful connection with everything, with everyone. So, I guess that's imagination, helping us enact something. enact our interdependence, become the interdependence that we already are. So then after that, that lasted for a long time. It lasted for hours and days until I went home to see my mother. Whoops! Should have never gone home to see my mother. Immediately the inner critic came in. Immediately everything. All my judging. All my complaining. Even about her food. She tried her best. So, there's an example of how ritual, we use imagination and then we bring in ritual, and that's an enactment of our imagination. We do it with our bodies, with our whole being. We enact our imagination. Mali Doma Somme says, without ritual, we are ships passing the night. Without ritual, we are ships passing the night. And Ajahn Chah told Jack Kornfield, call it Christianity or anything you like. The name doesn't matter. It's the practice that counts. So what ritual you do, and whether you call on Buddha or Jesus or your Buddha nature or your still nature or the Prajnaparamita mantra, it doesn't matter. It's the practice that counts. It's embodying your sense of interdependence and the quietness that exists in that interdependence when you're not dominated by that inner critic anymore. When the inner critic has become peripheral, way peripheral. Which is what happens. It happens to everybody who practices, who gives themselves to enacting the ritual practice. To everyone. Everyone. Jack Kornfield says, rituals are constructed of elemental materials to help us return to the ground in which we live. Elemental materials we use in all of our rituals here, but also in shamanism, in Christianity. Fire, water, earth, elemental stuff, which help us step out of time. Out of business. They put us out of business. They put us out of busyness. Inner critic is so busy. Put us out of that busyness. Put us out of that busyness. And then we're out of success and failure. And we're out of success and failure. Which doesn't mean we don't make a huge effort. But our effort is not constrained by that obsessive compulsive. Is this okay? Why didn't I do it this way? I should have done it the other way. Is it too late? Is she noticing? Etc., etc. On and on and on. So, we enact our imagination of interconnectedness and the stillness that is at the center of interconnectedness. We enact that in many, many different ways. Many, many different ways. And in all of the chants that we do here at Zen Center, and they do in other Zen centers, we end our chants in the same way. By calling on the ancestors for support. Calling on their teachers for support. Calling all beings for support. So we say always, all Buddhas, 10 directions, 3 worlds. Buddhas just means a wakeful person. That's all. Just means a wakeful person. So we're calling our own innate wakefulness and the wakefulness of all these people in the past. All these Suzuki Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, Dogen guys and girls. We're calling on them. Help me live wakefully. Help me live in stillness, which is always here, regardless of how much chaos there is swirling around me. Help me. Help me. All Buddhas, 10 directions. of four cardinal directions and the four in-between directions and the sky and the earth. We can't leave the sky and the earth out. They're very important. There are lots of beings in the earth need to help us. Want to help us. We just open up. Just enact the ritual. Enact the imagination of our interconnectedness to those worms and mealybugs and all those things down in the earth. And as I was saying, we do initiate different initiation ceremonies here. And this last fall, I just initiated about 15 or 16 people, and they had to each sew one of these out of a bunch of tiny pieces of cloth. Well, they are then enacting their imagination of their interconnectedness with all life. And they're doing it in stillness by not talking, by just sewing one stitch and then another stitch. And with each stitch, they're calling on Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And let's forget the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. They're calling on their teachers. Their teachers, the teaching, and the community for support. To do this, we need support. Because the inner critic is so dominating. We need support. We need support of all the teachers. All the teachers. All the teaching. The whole community. So they spend hours and days doing this. Some of them want to quit. A lot of them want to quit. Most of them probably want to quit. I know I wanted to quit when I did my first one. You know, the deal is, I shouldn't even tell you this, but the first time you do this, you have to do this all on your own. At least that's the way we do it. But by the time you get to do one of these brown ones, you have lots of people helping you. Anyway, that's the enactment. That's the enactment of your imagination that you are a Buddha. You are a Buddha. That just means you're a still being. You're a still open being. At your base, you all are. So you're... And we all, the caveat is that we have to watch out for ritual. And notice when it's turned into these are Jack Kornfield's words, a fossilized rote performance. We need to pay attention to that. When our ritual turns into a fossilized rote performance, we've lost our imagination. Our imagination is gone, and we're dead inside, and we're just going through the motions. So we have to re-engage with our imagination. So that it doesn't turn into something dead and habitual. And sure, we do it with our body, but it's not alive. And we shouldn't get too hung up on the right rituals and the wrong rituals, I don't think. Or the proper, improper use of type of ritual. We need to more do our rituals with our heart and just see if they connect us. Do they slow us down? Do they help us transform our body into a being of openness, of connectedness, rather than constraint? So now I'm going to tell a story that I told down at Hokkyoji about a ritual that I was involved in. So, about probably 3 years ago, my father died, and maybe four. And as the oldest child, I went out and sort of made sure that we had a funeral ceremony and got all the relatives together and did that stuff, and. Then there was the question of his ashes. And there was only my sister and I. And So his ashes were in a cardboard box. And my sister and I decided we would split them up. She said, "You can take half and I can take half." I said, "Fine." But I wanted to do something, but I didn't know what. I wanted to do something to connect and honor and be with him, and also help him pass on into nothingness, into stillness. Pass into it. So I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. And I went in the house with my sister, and she said, "Oh, let's just toss him in the backyard." And I thought, I said to Yvette, "No, I don't want to do that." And she just went out and tossed him in the backyard on the flowers. And maybe that was okay for her relationship with him, because she was close to him and she could just do that. But I couldn't do that. It just didn't feel good to me. And then my friend who was Buddha said, "Oh, well, come back to Zen Center. You're the Roshi there. You know, put him on the altar and do the 49-day thing. We have a 49-day thing we do." And that didn't feel right. My dad's an atheist. He hated this shit, especially the fact that I did it. That was he never really got over that. So I'm not going to inflict that on him, even if it's just ashes, you know. And it doesn't help me feel connected to him or him. So it seems like a rude thing to do, actually. So I have the ashes in the back seat of the car. And I'm driving around, but I'm not knowing what to do with them, right? And I'm out in this, in my home area, the San Francisco area. And then my cousin says, "Oh, Tim, the mausoleum. There's a mausoleum that he says, Grandma's ashes are in there. So-and-so's ashes are in there. So-and-so's ashes are in there." Well, I say, "Okay, let's go up to my wife. Let's go up to the mausoleum. We'll put them in the mausoleum." So we go up, and I take the ashes out of the car, and I go into the mausoleum. It's Christian. My dad hated Christians almost as much as Buddhists. I'm not going to do that. So I haul the ashes back in the cardboard box, put them in the back seat of the car, drive back to my home in Palo Alto. My wife by now is beginning to think, "Well, what's the deal here?" But she's been with me for a long time, so she's pretty cool. So I've still got the ashes in the backseat of the car, and I'm driving around, and my cousins are saying, "What'd you do with those ashes?" I think they're thinking I'm disrespectful or something. And then, well, then that's the last day, and it's time for us to go on the plane back to Minnesota. And Linda said, "You're not going to bring all these ashes back to Minnesota, are you? Especially if you're not going to take them to Zen Center." "No," I said, "let's go back up to San Francisco," which is where my dad's from. So we go back up to San Francisco, and we're driving around. And I have a very poor sense of direction. But I know my dad lived in different places in San Francisco. And so driving around, and finally we come to this house that I remember. And we just don't do it arbitrarily. We just do it a little circuitously. That I remember that's by the San Francisco Bay, by the sea. By the sea. The same sea that Bobby Shafter and I hung out at, right? Well, on the other side of the sea, we did. I mean, the other side of the bay. The same sea. And that's a house. My grandmother, I spent time with my grandmother there. It was where my father lived. And I said to Linda, "Oh, this is where the ashes need to go. They need to go down the embankment below the house and the sea." When I was there as a kid, I'd never been allowed to go down to the sea, because my grandmother said it was always too steep. Too steep, you can't go down there. So Linda and I went and rang the doorbell of the people in the house. We didn't know who lived there. And I had the box in the car because I didn't want to look too bizarre. And I told them who I was, and it's been my grandmother's house and my father's house, and they were very friendly, and they invited us in. And then I said, "Yes, and I as a matter of fact, my dad's died, and I have his ashes in the car, and I'd like to take him down to the sea." She said, "Oh, you can't go down to the sea; it's too steep." So I say to Linda, we will go down to the sea. I whisper that to Linda as we're going back out to the car. So then we pull the car out. We find a trail down there. There's a beach. I roll up my pants. I got the ashes still with me, and I'm able actually to walk over. And my grandmother's house is way up there, and I put that and I dumped the ashes in the sea. And that was just wonderful. It was wonderful. It felt like a great release. A great release, a great opening. You never know about these rituals. You know, you never know. You have to follow your heart. You have to get still enough just to follow your heart and see what happens. Don't worry about the inner critic. Don't worry about doing it wrong or right. Just feed your heart. If you feed your heart, you're feeding stillness. You're feeding openness. And sometimes you'll be confused. That's no big deal. Confusion is part of this whole process. So, rituals we need at work sometimes. A lot of people come to... And we spend how much of our time working? 40 hours a week for 30 years? Wow, we need some rituals. Of course, we got our coffee and our tea. But that's fine. Maybe we can do our coffee and our tea with some real sensitivity, so that when we pour the coffee, we can watch the coffee pouring. We can hear the bubbling into the cup. We can really look into the cup. Then it's a ritual. If you do that, it's not dead. Then you're activating your Buddha nature. You're activating your inner connection. Or maybe you'd have to do something like take a deep breath every hour. Maybe that's your ritual. Every hour, I'm going to set my iPhone so that every hour a little, nice little bell will go off. You know how an iPhone's that you can find the nice little bells. I haven't learned yet, but my wife and son have nice little bells. And that hour, you can just breathe for 3 minutes listening to the iPhone. And then, or maybe you can eat your lunch once a week without any talking and just really look at your sandwich. Really look at the color of the grains in the bread. Really taste it. Each bite. Maybe you can make that your ritual. There's so many things you can do, but it takes some imagination. Because just to sit here in meditation is wonderful, but we have to go out. We're always going out, and then we get overwhelmed immediately. So we need to reintroduce a little ritual to help us remember about the great stillness that never leaves us, even whether we are sick or healthy or depressed or manicky or dead or alive. It doesn't leave. How can it? And so the main ritual that we do in Zen is sitting. So somebody said, "Oh well, we're doing ritual-free Sundays now." I don't think so. We're sitting. We're doing meditation. We're doing meditation while they're meditating upstairs. First we meditate downstairs, then they meditate upstairs. And if you want to do a lot of meditation, do 40 minutes downstairs and then come do 20 minutes upstairs. And if you really want to do a lot of meditation, come to one of our retreats, one of our sesshins. We have I'd love to have you come to our high church retreat that starts on something like December 1st or 2nd and goes for a week. So that's our central ritual. And Dogen, this guy who sustained himself on paintings of rice cakes, he says that Zazen, sitting meditation, is such an important ritual that all the other rituals are secondary. If you learn how to just sit and be still and let your thoughts fall away and come back and fall away and twirl around and do whatever they want to do, just let them be, Don't try to mess with them. Don't try to inner critic them. That you'll experience the same awakening that Buddha did, that Katagiri Roshi did, that Tim did, that everybody did, that we all do. And so the sitting down is the enactment of the imagination. The sitting down as a Buddha with a straight spine to help you as a Buddha, as a Bodhisattva. So Dogen says, the Zazen I speak of is not meditation practice, because in a ritual we're not practicing for something else. We're doing it just as it is. We're manifesting the Dharma gate of peace and bliss by just putting ourselves in the meditation posture. The practice realization of awakening by just sitting. Just sitting. Or just standing. Just standing. Same. Exactly the same. How can it be different? The Zazen I speak of, Dogen says, is the decorous activity and natural expression of enlightenment. So the wakefulness is already here. We're just expressing it by doing the practice. Just expressing it. So, as Jack Kornfield says, imagination and ritual take us from the outermost to the innermost. And in the three refuges, the refuge, taking refuge in the teacher, taking refuge in the teaching, taking refuge in the community, we move from the outermost to the innermost. We start with the teacher as the Buddha. As the Buddha or the Suzuki Roshi or whomever. And then a moment of stillness and we discover our own still nature. So here's the Buddha, right here. We discover it. It's right here. In that little bit of space between our thoughts. And then, if we continue, we see beyond the Buddha nature, it's the nature of everything to be still and to be open. And the teaching, too. The teaching starts outside. I'm reading this. I'm studying this. I'm hearing Tim talk. Then it comes closer to us. And after a while, it's just our life. It's just life. And the same with the community. We start with a little community. In Henry V, Henry says, and there's a Shakespeare's Henry V, Henry says, you only need a few good men, a few men who are loyal and true. If they gather together, that's all you need. So we need a few good women and men who support each other in this meditation practice with loyalty, with trueness. We can't do it by ourselves. We need each other. That's Sangha in its infancy. But we need to be infants. We shouldn't try to jump over the infinite stage. We're all infants. We all need each other. But because we're infants, then we can... It's not just our little community. It's the big community. It's a big community. And it's not just the community of human beings. It's the community of grasses and trees and earths and waters. It's a huge community. So we go from the outermost to the innermost. And one thing we need to watch out for in the enactment of ritual, the enactment of imagination through ritual, is that we get stuck on the outermost. We get stuck on the outermost or on the in-betweenmost and go all the way in. We get stuck on the Buddha image or the American flag or the Buddha flag or the whatever. And then it's not drawing us in to something huge. We're separating. We're separating. So the ritual then becomes a way of separating, of supporting the inner critic. So the inner critic can say, oh yeah, this is it, finally. You're not doing it right, but she is. So we need to be careful of that. Because if it's a way of separating ourselves from all life, it's not the teaching that will help us. That will help us help others. So this process is about, as I said, it's about... it's about, well, the Zen teachers, the old Zen teachers say it's about skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. It's how you get it in you. You get it into your skin, flesh, bones, and marrow by enacting your imagination over and over again with your sitting or whatever it is that helps you connect to something much, much larger than you've ever than the inner critic ever acknowledged could be true. So much larger that it's not even large anymore. It's just drinking a glass of water. That's all it is. And nothing more, just drinking a glass of water. Okay, that's my talk. Questions, comments? Sure.
The day of my girlfriend's funeral, I actually performed a ritual, since you brought that up, had some letters and stuff from Maria, and as her sister's, her daughter's called up in Alton, with the family gatherings and stuff like that, I used the fire pit, and just as a ritual, I kind of sent letters from the queen, Maria and I back up into the sky like that. So
wonderful. Wonderful. Good for you. Good for you. Anybody else?
I find it interesting that the imagination is really what we are called on a lot of times.
Yep.
In the Buddha, when you first, I mean, you brought up the Rakusu.
Yeah.
Is based on what? Rice fields.
Yep.
So you have to imagine the rice fields that he saw and said, let's build, let's make a row out of rice fields.
Yeah.
And when I had the opportunity to sow this, and on the way down to Hokioji, I was riding my bicycle through cornfields. the row sutra, or the row chant, kept coming up in my mind how great the row of a Buddha. A field far beyond form and emptiness. Again, it's asking us to be imaginative, to imagine all of this coming together into this. You know? The other thing that I've been stuck on it is there's a line about making a golden Buddha out of a blade of grass. And I haven't gotten the hook yet, or that twist that you need for it to open up for you. Because it's just an interesting play on words. It's like feeding yourself on rice cakes or painted rice cakes. It's just that there's that imagination that, how do you do that? How would you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the koans are like that. Stepping off a 100-foot pole, or you're held in the top of a tree by your teeth and you can't do anything. And somebody asks you, what is Zen? And what are you going to tell them? How do you answer that? You know? There's a lot of imagination throughout the practice.
That's right.
It's a lot of fun. We do get to use challenge ourselves. And even in everyday use.
Thank you. Anybody else? Thanks.
Well, thank you everyone for joining us this morning.